Hello and welcome to the episode titled Cultivation. In this episode, I, Rosie Benn, and Elizabeth Ward will talk about where our practices cross over, namely in the garden. Elizabeth Ward is a choreographer and performer currently living in Vienna. Her work explores the collective histories of dance lineages accumulated in a dancer's muscle memory as a living archaeology. Her most recent work, Dancing Demons, a piece that explores the haunting and complicated political history of early modern dance, made it to premiere at Tanzquartier in 2020 before theatres worldwide closed. Her project, Antifascist Ballet School, was presented by Fine Westwoche, Wien Woche and Der Blöde Dritte Mittwoch. Between 2014 and 2018, she collaborated with electronic producer AC Boy on a techno ballet project. Elizabeth is engaged in an ongoing artistic research project entitled Phototropism and the Lamp and Fever, investigating performance anxiety and informed by plant medicines. While Elizabeth's current project looks into elements of garden within dance, choreography and performative practice, we'll be linking that with my project titled What's Easier to Train, a Cat or a Human? In which, through performative storytelling, I explore the ethical paradoxes encountered when raising cats as a vegan, as well as inspiration from on-site artistic research within forest gardening, biocyclic vegan agriculture, and animal sanctuaries.
Welcome to the Underland.
So, we're in a garden. Midday in our garden.
There are no clouds in the sky.
The sun is bright.
And the top of the tree is sunbathing.
It's still winter, but it's one of these days that feels like you're already through spring.
This morning in the garden I saw in the bushes there were some old buds with seeds from last year, and next to it were the buds from this year coming through already.
That's beautiful. Today also I saw, maybe 3 days ago I saw one flower and then two flowers. And today I saw so many flowers that I didn't think about them in numbers. I just thought about them in abundance of flowers. They were yellow, lots of different yellow flowers in the garden.
Yeah, I was in the park the other day and there was like a carpet of these stems that have been there for the last maybe 2 weeks. Last week I was also there. And I was really surprised that there was no flowers there yet. They're just like a carpet of stems. They're like really in anticipation of the bloom.
And this time of year, this spring, I really like to think of the very little I know about, the very little I understand about Chinese medicine and this idea of spring being this time of the wood element, and that it's one that takes great force. Like, to think about the force needed to break through the ground and to become those stems, and the idea that maybe we also experience that in our lives. Like, there's something out of coming out of this winter slumber, even if we're living with electronic lights or electrical lights, and busy lives and we kind of forget the hibernation. But me, at least, I think I'm actually a bear. And that, or maybe some other kind of hibernating creature. But I really feel like my body tone gets really low in the winter. So much so that different body workers I've gone to have commented on it, and they say, I've once been told, you feel like what I imagine a hibernating bear would feel like.
Well,
and I once went to this body worker like through the winter, and then I took a pause and I came back in the summer, and she was so surprised, which was funny because I felt like, oh, but this is who I am. But I think she had an idea of who I was based on how my body responded in the winter. But I know I'm not a constant creature, and I have the sense you aren't either.
Yeah, I would say that I have never felt the winter hibernation so much like I did this year.
Yeah.
Like, I would say that I'm maybe a squirrel in the sense that I kind of like hop around on the trees and like store things in my mouth and maybe think about them for a while. But I'm not sure if squirrels go into complete hibernation. Mm-hmm. But this year I kind of did.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, yeah, to have your body kind of make you need to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And not be able to scurry like you usually do was really...
Was it scary at times?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, yeah. Because after something goes on for longer than a week, a month, you start to wonder when actually it will end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it has...
What else is in the garden?
Hmm.
I mean, I think this time of year, it's a lot about seeing potential, like seeing what can be done, but also having patience. Because we're not necessarily out of who knows, with climate change, but traditionally, we would not necessarily be out of like the period that frost could occur.
Right.
So even though we think we're in spring, I think we have to remind ourselves that we're still in winter right now. So it's a lot about patience, because if we clear too much, it also exposes not only the plants, but potentially whatever insect friends are hunkered down underneath all of this.
You're also thinking about gardens as a dance as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, the next project that I'm working on, I'm somehow working from the metaphor of how to make a dance that's like an overgrown formal garden. So let's say let's say we're in kind of a rural area right now. That maybe 100 years ago, there was some wealth, it's definitely Europeanized space, maybe somehow. And then we come to a wall, and in the wall there's kind of a broken door. And we enter it, and we enter into like this walled off, what we might know as a secret garden.
And we've worked together in the Antifascist Ballet Project before. I know that you're a person that is very sensitive to the body and also to the group as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it really fascinating that in your next project you're going to be working with the idea of like dance and choreography in a garden.
Yeah, maybe I can explain a little bit this idea, and a couple things, like, so Rosie and I were part of this anti-fascist ballet school project, and I grew up in ballet, and then I've had a career in experimental dance, which is great, because then other things are possible, and yet there's part of me that still loves, like, practicing ballet. So for many years I was trying to understand that, and I also felt like there was something like part of me thought of practicing ballet as archaeology. My childhood dream job was that I wanted to be an archaeologist, and I've actually never taken an archaeology class besides the one I took when I was like 8 years old at some summer camp. You know, like, I don't, so this is a totally romanticized idea, but I had the sense that if you practice a dance form that has like a 500-year history, and it's a 500-year history that is very much in the shape of like an imperial order, and yet was like kind of ingesting and changing and taking over more like peasant dance or like dances from other places, and kind of like shaping and commodifying them and turning them into like a specific thing. I guess I was curious if there was a way of, if through practicing, if there was something to be learned through these, like if archaeology is a history of sediment, like if someone goes on a dig, they're digging through time, actually, like they're digging down through these different layers of time. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of curious if, as someone who studied ballet from 4 to 18, I feel like I've had a layer of sediment past me that came from different geographies, different ideologies, different, like there's a lot, like ballet is actually something that's very geographical in its difference. Like schools of thought are very different in different places, based on what kind of lineage has stayed and been passed on. And so how to link it to the garden? I like gardens. Like, I'll just be really honest about that. When I was an undergraduate, I couldn't decide between focusing on dance or focusing on botany and ecology. And in the end, I focused on dance because I failed a hydrology test and realized, like, I don't know calculus. Maybe I'm not going to actually become a scientist. Like, but I have this past of like deeply loving plants, and it also comes from the place of having grown up a city kid. Mm-hmm. Like, somehow I realized at some point that I could instantly like look at a car and tell you what kind of car it was, but I didn't know what the trees were around me. When mm-hmm. I was like 18 or mm-hmm. so, I realized, like, or I could spot someone and tell they were carrying, like, I don't know, whatever brand. Mm-hmm. Like, I had been grown up through brands, but I didn't actually know the reality around me that we were depending on. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, back to the garden. So there's this dance form that I grew up in, and even if I work in experimental dance, somehow I come out of this lineage of a 500-year history that, like, ultimately is connected to European imperial courts. That's strange. Like, I guarantee whoever I descended from was not in an imperial court 500 years ago. So that's strange. But then I read this really interesting chapter in a book that talked about how both early Baroque court dance, which became ballet, and Baroque garden design were both means to try to make visible a certain ideology around the world and around like this idea of nature, this idea of like somehow, it's very Christian actually, this idea of like a these Baroque gardens. It was a way of like actually creating the space for contemplation that you could walk through, and then you see this like nature has to be framed or held or trimmed and trained. And that's also what they did to the plants. It's also what was done to the bodies.
Right. Thinking of those times, like cause, you know, this restrictions of the body with cause its all kinds of garments.
Yeah, and this idea of what's natural, what's like of a type of nature, and so since I do not. You could say like, okay, well, what do you do if you've had 500 years of imprinting on bodies, on plants, you know, like on cities? You have all of this, we're kind of in the soup of it. And if there was a way to kind of use this metaphor of a dance like a garden and spend time in Baroque gardens that we have in Vienna and look at them and see like, where do I see my dance practice in here? Like, how can I understand how my body was trimmed and trained as a young person, and what I was taught, like rules of the stage, like how do I see, A, do I agree with this person, do I see similarities? And then pretty instantly I did, in spatial structure. So going back to architecture.
Right.
This like, these ideas of, and it goes back to these ideas of sacred geometry, because both were trying to make visible a certain idea of what sacred geometry was.
Certain like ideals of like composition and shape and form.
A lot of symmetry, a lot of like lines and circle, like where lines and circles intersect, and this kind of a lot of symmetry, like and mirroring, and
which like, that's why I find it so fascinating that then your next point of question was like, how can I unravel that in a way, wasn't it? Like how to like rewild this garden in a way, or what was that your question?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is that we know land goes fallow. Like we know that you can trim and train and prune and weed and blah, 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 blah. And as soon as you're gone, the dandelions come, you know, like the nature has its own logic.
There are many other plants, right? Like the plants have other plants, and it's not one great plant that is like designing this other wilderness. It's another ideal.
Yeah.
It's just like there are a lot of agendas going on in that space.
Yeah, there's a lot, and I'm also really drawn to this idea that a lot of the plants that we grew up calling weeds are actually medicines. And so I like to imagine this dance practice as if someone once upon a time came through and said, like, we are going to make this plot of land in the image of the highest ideal of my belief of what, like, some kind of organization that reflects the cosmos. Also, they thought they were reflecting the cosmos through these kind of things. And then, I don't know, something happens, they go away, it's abandoned, no one's there. Nature and all of its many creatures and logics, like, they do their thing. And then you walk into it, And so where are these traces of the old? Like, what is this place? What would it be if you see the traces of the old and something else?
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of detritus from the last year. I actually worked as a gardener for 10 years in New York City. And because I worked in like private gardens in Brooklyn, like the backyards, because these row houses, they often have like very narrow but long gardens. And then also I worked on rooftop gardens of like mega millionaires in Manhattan. And in all of these places, it was, gardening was a lot about tidying up, about like making it clean, making it presentable. It wasn't necessary ecological either, because some of the things were, we would like replace plants that like maybe you could grow again the next year, but maybe not, and there was limited space, so you would take them out and put something else in. But I, because I had this, over a decade, like I had 10 seasons working in New York City as a gardener, I'm so trained to tidy in the garden. At the same time, I'm kind of a lazy gardener, because I was, like, many, many years ago, I had a backyard, and I was influenced by a friend who had this book that I don't remember, and it was about, like, a method of agriculture where you try to do the least disturbance as possible. And so I think it meant that, like, my neighbors were really annoyed at me because I let everything be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tried to plant in between. Yeah, so that...
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Like, I find sometimes if I'm going to work in the garden, I feel myself like, oh, working, like, what am I going to do? Then I want to order things that might, you know, trimming things down because that feels satisfying.
Yeah.
But that's not... very often not necessarily what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And it really is an important process, like just take a step back before ripping things off the ground.
Right.
And actually watching at what's already happening there.
Yeah.
And when you take out one thing from one place, how does that affect its neighbor?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what does it make space for?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it has a strong concurrence and you pull out one kind of plant which might be a threat to the other one could move into that space and also get stronger. So it's really like this, thinking before doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I find really interesting about gardening, and in some ways I feel like this thinking before doing, I'm so there with it that I never could become a successful commercial garden designer. But the people I know who did, it's funny, I have many, many friends that studied, that I went to school with, who like were painting majors, and now they're gardeners. And I think that there's really a link there, because it's color and texture, the different, and it's actually, I was about to say the difference, but it's also the same. It's this thing with time. And I think people who, like painters, it's often, mm-hmm. they have this like,
mm-hmm.
it's about these layerings and time, right. And like maybe even painting over what you did before, yeah. And layering,
mm-hmm.
and there's...
composition.
The composition, I really think... Now, when I look at gardens, I often think of them as paintings.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And when you were speaking earlier about these, like these different shapes and mm-hmm. lines and like these mm-hmm. designs, I then had to think about, for example, permaculture, which mm-hmm. also actually works with shapes and lines and things like this, and then that in relation to forest gardening.
I was just thinking about forest gardening.
Yeah, which is like for me the next interesting point, because of course like permaculture is working with these like cyclical elements and wilder areas in a way, so it's not this symmetry, it's more like the process of like interrelating. But forest gardening is this way of working like what you just described of, with like things that are already there and how you want to cultivate it, you know, it recognizes it like a forest dynamic, you know, create spaces for like fruititious for many different kinds of like agendas, if we call it that, for many of the agendas of different beings. But it also recognizes, like, you know, a person's will to eat, as it does the, you know, maybe a mice's will to eat the roots, which is another problem.
Yeah.
But I think that's an interesting like way of working with the land and with different plants.
I'm fascinated. Okay, two things. I'm fascinated about how much of your research has to do with agriculture, especially because a couple days ago we were talking about something and you said, oh, I, you know, you're telling a story and then you said that shows what a city kid I am.
Is this about the mole?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. So I grew up in a city, and so I am one of these people, which I guess like many other people in a city, that could have a romantic idea of what it is to live in the countryside and enjoys to escape the city space to, you know, forests or parks and so on. And the more that I come into contact with people who live there, who work in these places, who deal with the task of producing food, it's less romantic than it seems, but it also is often then more sensual and more detailed, the tasks, than it actually seems as well. And I think the reason why I find agriculture particularly interesting, because who is dealing with this question of like trying to work non-violently with other beings, but also staying with this topic of food production, where there is a necessary function, you know, like I think it's such an interesting like way to ground into a lot of like theories about, you know, topical right now, post-humanism or biocentrism and so on, and to ask ourselves, okay, but what about the task? How do we go about being, you know, like this question of anthropocentrism, when as humans we have certain needs, like needing to eat, for example, it's a basic one. So how do we go about combining these like wishes and then the needs at the same time? As having been someone who raised cats. So this is how it brought me to it, right? Like with being vegan, but then I have a cat. I raised the cats.
Right.
And
cats aren't vegan.
Cats are not vegan. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And cats are also not non-violent. So it's kind of this like ambivalent space between those things.
Which, for anyone listening wondering what this sub-story was about, like being such a city kid, basically your cat at one point brought a mole to you. And you didn't know that that's what moles looked like because you only knew moles from cartoons.
Yeah. And then I realized I'd just been thinking of moles in my head from the moles from Wind in the Willows.
Yeah. I can relate, actually, in many ways. Well, I know you have the experience of speaking with and interviewing someone.
Right.
Who inherited a farm.
Right.
And then decided to apply these ideas of the forest agriculture?
Yeah, farming? Like agroforestry. But actually it's a smaller version, so it's more forest gardening than it is forest agriculture. This is like Roland Teufel, so I was visiting him and he is got a space on his grandparents' farm, so they have like a conventional farm. And he has this like site of experimentation on.
Can we just go back to what you mean by conventional farm? So like, his grandparents, they were farming it when? Like in the 50s?
I suppose it's in the 50s, and it might have also an older inheritance. I would have to like double check that. But they are growing mostly like wheat.
Okay.
And they previously had sheep as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I say conventional in the sense that it's monoculture.
Okay.
And conventional in the sense that
fertilizer.
They're using fertilizer. The main focus is on like the yield. It's on like, you know, having a product and that being sold. So there's like the design of it that's like conventional, and then there's like the aim of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the forest garden, it's working with these. So what Rolly is doing is he has his own tree nursery and bush nursery. He has like all these different bushes that he's like expanding on, and smaller trees. And then he has this like site of experimentation that used to be a sheep field.
Mm-hmm.
So previously flat and green grass and
mm-hmm.
so on. And now it has hills and dips, and there are fruit trees growing there, and there are bushes, all kinds of berries, herbs. Mostly perennials,
mm-hmm.
but also some annuals as well. So some vegetables that you do harvest each year
mm-hmm.
anew. But the idea is to do no digging. And so that's where the long-term plants come in. And that's maybe brings the point of time as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
if you're working with like conventional agriculture, it's a yearly harvest.
Right.
Whereas with forest agriculture, it's such a like test of patience, because you can, you start and you're calculating like 10, 15, 30 more years. Like that's the kind of like yield that you're talking about,
yeah.
you know, calculating.
Yeah.
But it's a process of investment, because although it's maybe more work at the beginning
mm-hmm.
and it requires like a lot of like pondering. Like I was observing Rolly, he's a very like, calm and kind of like contemplative
mm-hmm.
person
mm-hmm.
and that's why you can see why he does what he does, because it's a lot about, you know, watching and observing and adapting.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the work at the beginning, but when it comes towards the, you know, further in the process, when the plants are in fruition, when your trees are much stronger, when your bushes are stronger, you have to trim back and you have to watch how they're interacting. But you don't need to dig every year. You don't need to like heavily fertilize every year. You've got cycles
yeah.
going on that are kind of like...
And this big machinery too, right?
Right, that as well. Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You don't need the fuel to to
right.
cut things down, because you're not cutting them, you're trimming them.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. Okay, so that's taking place on what was the grazing land for the sheep.
Right.
And what about this area where the wheat used to be farmed? Because that would be a place that would be this yearly cycle
mm-hmm.
of probably, if we're on a large scale, spreading the wheat via big machines.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm assuming this at some point, maybe fertilizing something,
yeah.
letting it grow, and
yeah.
then the machines coming and cutting it back.
Right.
So it's also going down to soil
mm-hmm.
every year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exposed.
And that's still happening there. And that's why I find it such an interesting project, because it's this like transition phase happening in like a real thick of the moment, but the grandparents are still there doing this conventional farming, and he's there with this like experimental side, like this kind of planned architectural rebellion going on, but
interesting,
but that requires like so much care and consideration, and they're happening in the same place.
That's great, because I was also thinking probably the way he's working isn't going to yield the amount of money that you need to pay for the farm. Farms aren't free to have.
Farms are not free to have, but if you've inherited them, then you're lucky enough to have a place, right?
Yeah.
But of course, you have to, for example, like pay to be part of certain license systems.
Right.
You have to be think about your taxes and so on. And if you're having machinery, repairing, fuel,
yeah.
all sorts of stuff. Well, that's again though in the model of like farming that would be to produce, to sell, to make profit. Whereas what Rolly's interested in and what he practices is more of like a circular economy. So he's
mm-hmm.
working with like gift economy, and is interested in subsistence farming, which
mm-hmm.
means that you just grow what you need, and you know the rest
mm-hmm.
you can
yeah.
take, use for
right.
forms of exchange.
Yeah, but then by still having the conventional part of the farm, you can pay for the farm.
Right, that's how it got there. That's how we even got there, yeah.
While you're investing in this other thing that will pay off later.
Right.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's really great. The grandparents said yes too.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm really curious like how that develops. But then I think like one thing I would love to like ask you then in dance, see when you're creating this space, you go to this garden. I asked you like, okay, so what are you putting there? So what's going to be in the garden? And you so nicely said, well,
I forget.
You said it's not about what I want to put in the garden. It's about seeing what's already there.
Yeah.
And I was wondering like how that is translated into working with a group of people.
Well, I think maybe it goes back to something that in the very beginning you said about this, like, how we work together as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing from this ballet training that I stay interested in, but maybe not in the way that it would be performed in the Stade Opera, which is across the street from us now, is this idea of the corps de ballet, like this body of the ballet, and the body of the ballet is composed of individuals that become a kind of collective body,
mm-hmm.
that this collective body dances. And in general, I'm really interested in this idea of like a social collective body, but not a body that says like, Rosie loses all of her individuality and has to be just like me, or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think this, whenever I make work, my work is always very much connected to the people in the work. Like, I don't make work that I can just interchange the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
if you and I were going to make a dance together, it would be really important to me that, like, I make a dance for you.
Oh, wow.
that's really for and from you somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, I don't try to like make the dance for Helen on you.
Mm-hmm.
So in seeing what's there, it's also about kind of like starting to really get a sense of like who clicks with what, who. And the other thing I can say, like I often work kind of in between set steps and these imaginary scores that can drive some people crazy.
Why?
Because it is not static.
Okay.
I won't say we're in a garden and over there is an apple tree.
Okay.
And then that's the truth.
Okay. So how do you find out what is there, or who says what is there then?
I think we have to, it's very slippery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's there and then it's not there, because actually we're just in this room. There's nothing else here with us. And yet we have to, like, somehow agree on this imaginary space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somehow, I'm super interested in this. Like, how can we activate and inhabit both the actual room that we're in,
mm-hmm.
and an imaginary space at the
mm-hmm.
same time.
Mm-hmm.
But this imaginary space doesn't take us out of the here and now, and
mm-hmm.
the here and now doesn't
restrict
exactly to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And because we can say, like, okay, we can say we are in a room with a wood floor and white walls and a big window with kind of gray clouds, and maybe the sun is poking through to the north of us now because it's a little brighter, with some chairs and a table and a mic and a computer and two people sitting on chairs talking to each other with a bunch of cables. That's like concrete, like we can agree on that.
Yeah.
And then how fun is it if we can also agree that, I don't know, that we can step into something else together too.
Mm-hmm.
And that will always be slippery because it's our agreement that makes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you start to build that and kind of lay it down, then there can be things that activate that kind of it's like kids play.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. So that's how I think of dances,
mm-hmm.
actually, more is that how do we negotiate building an imaginary world for ourselves that then we can inhabit, and it's going to be slippery, and some images are not going to work,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it's through the sediment again. It's like layering and layering and layering and layering and layering, and maybe we can be together,
mm-hmm.
through the difference.
Right, which makes me think of collage, which is like we've been making collage from old books and anthotype, putting these different images together.
Yeah.
But I was talking with someone yesterday that actually also the space that we created and the different activities are a collage as well.
They are, yeah.
And that's also interesting if you think about collage as a translation of composting, because you're talking about sediment, right?
Right.
You're talking about these different layers of like possibilities and ideas.
You know, to kind of wrap it up.
Yeah.
Rosie had given me a question before we started this, but it had to do with composting actually, and it had to do with this. For me, these questions about making this dance, but I think we can. We can throw it back to this kind of exhibition space research project opening that we've invited people to this last week. And in thinking about compost, I thought, you let it sit and then you turn it over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we've done here too.